Today, the U.S. Supreme Court hears arguments on whether there's a constitutional right to same-sex marriage. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Emily Woodbury, in for Ben Kiefer. This hour, we'll hear the stories of the people who brought their cases to the Supreme Court, who describe themselves as accidental activists, trying to gain things like adoption rights, or the right to include a spouse on a death certificate. And in the first half, I'll talk with the authors of Equal Before the Law, How Iowa Led Americans to Marriage Equality. They argue that the Varnum decision influenced national opinion on same-sex marriage. That's all coming up after this news from NPR. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Emily Woodbury, in for Ben Kiefer. As the U.S. Supreme Court hears arguments today on whether there's a constitutional right to same-sex marriage, let's take a look at where we are and where we came from, especially here in Iowa, the third state to legalize same-sex marriage, with the case of Varnum v. Breehan that held the state's limitation of marriage to heterosexuals violated the Equal Protection Clause of the Iowa Constitution. Later this hour, I'll be joined by legal expert Todd Pettis to discuss the possible impact of the cases in front of the Supreme Court. But first, let's go back a few steps. In 2008, before an Iowa Supreme Court ruling that allowed same-sex marriage in the state, opinion polls showed 56% of Americans opposed same-sex marriage. That number has steadily decreased. In fact, a Washington Post ABC News poll from a few days ago shows that 61% of Americans now support same-sex marriage. Same-sex marriage is now legal in 37 states. 18 states have legalized it in the past 6 months alone. In Iowa Public Radio's Des Moines studio are my guests this hour, Tom Witowski and Mark Hansen. They're co-authors of Equal Before the Law, How Iowa Led Americans to Marriage Equality. The book gives a behind-the-scenes look into the Varnum decision while arguing that Iowa led the national trend towards acceptance of same-sex marriage. For 30 years, Tom Witowski has covered Iowa politics, law, business, and sports for the Des Moines Register. Welcome to the show, Tom.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it, Aaron.
And Mark Hansen spent over 30 years writing sports, metro, and feature page columns for the Des Moines Register. Hi, Mark.
How are you doing?
Good, good. Well, thank you both for joining us. So, from reading your book, I would assume that you both argue that Iowa led the nation to where it is today with the Varnum decision in 2009. But before we go into that and how Iowa influenced the national landscape, briefly remind us what happened with that case. Who were the plaintiffs and what was being decided?
Well, there were six plaintiff couples, all from various parts of Iowa, three lesbian couples, three male couples. A couple of the families had, couple of the couples, excuse me, had families. They ranged in ages from younger in their 20s and 30s to an older couple here in Des Moines, Dave Twombly and Larry Hoke. They were approached by a lawyers group, Lambda Legal, from Chicago, which had begun working on the question of what state might be more amenable to looking at the issue about restrictions on marriage as opposed to others. It was a fairly long process, actually. The couples themselves really did not get involved until about 2005. The impetus of the whole issue eventually getting to the Supreme Court started a long time before then, in fact.
I think that you mentioned outsiders came in, and I think that's a preconception that a lot of people have. And they did come from the outside, but the local people, the activists in this state, basically begged them to come in and help them get this done. And they had to, you know, when people say, what are all these outsiders doing coming into the state? Well, they had to convince these people from New York and Chicago that this was the place that might turn things around.
Mm-hmm. And in that convincing people that Iowa could be the place where things turn around, you know, I mean, I think Iowa often has a reputation of being conservative. And in your book, you describe the state as a, quote, purple-clad political cross-dresser. Do you think that plays into this?
Well, I think it did for a couple of reasons. One, the state's history, and there was a lot of examination of the state's history in terms of the law, has always been very committed towards civil rights, going all the way back to the first Supreme Court, territorial Supreme Court decision in the In re Ralph case, which was about a slave who had come from Missouri to Iowa to buy his freedom from his slaveholder. And the slaveholder tried to take him back, and the territorial court said they weren't going to allow it because in Iowa people were free. The entire genesis of how this lawsuit started, I think, really did start with a little girl who was sitting at her breakfast table talking to her mothers, listening to them talk about how they weren't married. And she looked up at them and said, "What do you mean you're not married?" And from that point, that couple started talking to other couples who then started talking to other people. And as time went on, it's sort of generated its own momentum to take on this case.
And talk a little bit more about that family, that the little girl that you mentioned, McKinley Barbarosk. And, you know, you talk about in the book that this was one of the first times on a national scale that children were really being involved in this conversation.
Yeah, that's right. And I think when she said that, "You're not married," there were tears rolling down her cheeks. I mean, it was a really traumatic experience for her. But in the past, you know, one of the reasons against same-sex marriage was, you know, kids can't be around these people. They're not like the rest of us. And, you know, in this case, that kind of, the children for the first time kind of became, you know, a key part of the reason why this should be allowed. And she was terrific. McKinley, I think she was, you know, one of the Lambda lawyers called her the heart and soul of the case. And I think that's exactly what she was. I mean, why shouldn't she have the right to have married parents if they so want to? Why do all the other kids get to have married parents and she doesn't? And you know, I think when the Supreme Court looked into the California proposition a while back, one of the justices, Kennedy, raised that question. He said there were 40,000 children in California living with same-sex couples, and those children want their parents to have full recognition and status. And basically he was saying, why not? Don't these children deserve a voice?
What's really interesting, Aaron, in this whole story is how things happened in consecutive ways. I mean, not one person was responsible for this lawsuit. It was a group of people. Sharon Malero, a lawyer here in Des Moines, had been working on the issues. There were others around the state who basically saw the case in a way that they wanted to know why they should not be allowed to be married in Iowa. What was the real purpose of putting restrictions on them? And it just gradually went forward from that case. There was a divorce case up in Sioux City, where a judge ruled or allowed to dissolve their civil union. That was a key to the point. So there were small steps along the way, but all very, very vital steps as this thing built up.
What else was unique about the Varnum decision?
Well, there were several unique things about the decision. First, it was unanimous. As it stands today, it is still the only court in the our appeals court that had that voted unanimously for it. It also, the uniqueness of using children as plaintiffs or as co-plaintiffs in the case, that was the first time that had ever happened. And from that time on, just about every lawsuit across the country included children. In that sense, it was really quite a unique case.
I think another thing that I think we shouldn't ignore here is the fact that this was the first case that originated out of the heartland. This was mainstream America. And what Justice Cady did, I thought he did something brilliant. And he was talking about how these aren't counterculture East and West Coast, you know, crazy stuff. These are mainstream core American values that they're talking about here. And I think he might have been the first to stress that point. Do you think so, Tom?
In the sense that Iowa was out there in the middle of the country, probably is considered the most average of states in the country, to decide that a law restricting marriage to a man and a woman was in violation of the Constitution, particularly in light of the public opposition that existed at the time. It was quite extraordinary and unique. There were several cases in other states, I'm thinking of New York in particular, where basically the Supreme Court said, we don't want to touch this, that this is an issue that we think should be left to the voters to decide. Now, that is a legitimate argument, but the court here basically said, as we look at this case, we do not see a purpose for this law, and therefore we can't allow it to stand.
Hmm. Well, and you mentioned, you know, people looking to Iowa as this Midwestern state deciding on this. I think that has a lot of similarities with the Iowa caucus as well. You know, people looking to Iowans to kind of decide on something. And so do you think that Iowans, you know, taking a look at this issue really influenced public opinion on this? People from other states were looking and thought, well, you know, if Iowans are looking at it this way, maybe I could too.
Yeah, I think it gave other states, other Midwestern states, not all of them, but it kind of made the case that this is an issue that people care about all over the country. And I think it did pave the way for others to kind of jump in and say, well, you know, if they can do it, why can't we get something going?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think one of the major thrusts of the Iowa decision is this. It disrupted the way that most people looked at this issue. And they asked themselves, well, what is all that about? And it basically prompted a whole bunch of conversations, I think, all around the country saying, all right, what is the purpose of restricting marriage to a man and a woman? Is it really legitimate? I also think it prompted a lot more folks who are gay and lesbian to basically start talking about it more openly. And as we have seen, there has been this gradual change in attitude and public opinion about the homosexual community as well as same-sex marriage. And I think in a lot of ways, Iowa started that. Yes, Massachusetts was the first case. Then there was Connecticut. But if you take a look at the polling data over the period of time that this has gone on, it actually started to tick up in 2009. That's the first really substantive or substantial change in opinion that you begin to see. And then it just progressed, you know, to where it is today.
I think they did a marvelous job of picking the plaintiffs, too, Tom. I think when you look at them, it's just this whole, it runs the whole gamut. There's this older couple who they were in their late 60s, now in their 70s, who were teachers, school teachers. And they were, you know, they were middle class. They were like everybody else, only they couldn't actually come out and say who they really were. And I think you can run down the whole roster like that. There's a couple up in Sioux City who had all these foster children, and we're just doing a magnificent job. And just to get them out there and say, look at this, and then look at this little girl who wants to have married parents. I thought the whole thing was, very, very well choreographed.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Emily Woodbury in for Ben Kiefer. We're discussing the Varnum decision in light of the U.S. Supreme Court hearing oral arguments today on same-sex marriage. And I'm joined here by retired Des Moines Register reporters Tom Witowski and Mark Hansen. They're also freelance journalists and co-authors of the new book, Equal Before the Law, How Iowa Led Americans to Marriage Equality. And if you want to join our conversation, you can give us a call at 1-866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk or email us at rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. And on the line, we have Wally from Bradford. And Wally wants to talk a little bit about Iowa's justices. We're doing a lot of praising of Iowa. Iowa's been very progressive. in the courts over our history. But Wally, what's your concern here? What's your question?
I would respectfully remind your guests, and I know they don't need reminding of this, but before Iowa got it right, before they became deserving of all these kudos, almost like Garrison Keillor's mythical Lake Wobegon, where all the children are above average, and Iowa is this clear-cut leader of the nation in so many things, I would remind them that Iowa shamefully and horrifically voted three Supreme Court justices out of office, largely courtesy of big money and conservative activists, before they got it right. And those three need to be remembered for their dedication and for their willingness to stand up for what was right. And let's remember that those people got a midlife job change that they weren't applying for.
Well, thank you so much for your comment, Wally. Tom, Mark, who wants to handle that first?
I will. And in the book, we tackle the retention election, both in 2010 and 2012. And it was a difficult time in this state. Obviously, three members of the Supreme Court, they were the first and only three members of the court to ever be thrown off the court for what they did. Now, I look at it a little bit differently. I understand Wally's perspective on this and those who criticize that effort. You know, they certainly have that right, and a lot of people now probably agree with it. But what I do think happened was this. I think it also forced the conversation to continue. Today in the Supreme Court, Justice Roberts said that he thought a decision by the court would end the debate over this, and he doesn't know if that's the right thing to do. I think the retention fight in 2010 and then in 2012 continued the discussion. And I think as time went on, people began to recognize what the right thing to do was, or to at least accept this, to allow it to just continue on to the point where I don't really think it's much of an issue anymore.
I totally agree. And I think you have to remember, and I hear what you're saying, and I think you're making a good point. I think the retention vote was really important because I think that opened people's eyes. And even the Iowa bar, who kind of sat back and watched it happen the first time, got in there finally and said, we can't let this happen again. So when Wiggins was up, they put on the full court press basically, and they did things. They had this game plan that they followed through, whereas before it was just, you know, poor Marcia and, you know, the other two hanging out there and left to their own devices. And they didn't want, as former justices, they didn't feel comfortable advocating for themselves. But no one else really did either. But the second time around, it was a whole different game. And I think that, you know, one of the main contributions to the second retention election was Obama just came in and, you know, they kind of rode his coattails. But I think it's...
Well, we were asked that when the three justices, Justice Turnus, Justice Streisand, and Justice Baker, received the Profile of Courage Awards at the Kennedy Library back in 2012, Sonia Streit came up to me, and this was before the David Wiggins retention election, and she asked me, quite frankly, do you think that they will get buyer's remorse? And at that moment, I didn't know. I really didn't.
I didn't think it was would.
And we didn't know. But obviously they did. Now, granted, 350,000 more people voted in that election in 2012 than did in 2010. But the fact is, I think it is pretty clear that the state got buyer's remorse, from the standpoint of judicial independence. Whether or not there was that much of an endorsement change in terms of the Varnum decision, that's tough to tell. But I guess the reality is this, is that we are in a state now where we've had it, same-sex marriage, for 6 years. With the exception of the presidential candidates who came to Iowa last weekend, there seems to be a much more of a unanimity to allow that change to continue on. And from that standpoint, that's how this state has learned. I mean, remember, you know, the old Meredith Willson line about Iowa Iowans being able to stand nose to nose for an hour and a half and never see eye to eye. I think this was one of those examples where they did, and as time has gone on, they've learned to accept it.
Now, you both talked about how the Varnum decision changed things locally, it changed things nationally, changed public opinion, got more people talking about this. How do you feel the Varnum decision will impact the cases currently in front of the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court, or will it?
That's a tough. Well, first of all, there's so much case law now, at least on the lower court levels, from all the different circuits. And there has been, with the exception of the four states that we're arguing today, there's been a pretty much of a unanimity of opinion that those bans on same-sex marriage violate the federal Constitution. If, just for the sake of argument, that the U.S. Supreme Court, and I know you're going to have Todd Pettis on, and he can answer this probably better than I can. My understanding is that even if the Supreme Court would decide that there is no federal, that the federal Constitution mandates allowing same-sex couples to marry, Iowa's decision in Varnum v. Breen would continue to stand because it was based solely on the Iowa Constitution, which is considered much more progressive than the federal Constitution in several instances. And I would just point out to a really quick case, the Racy 2 case, which the federal Supreme Court had made a decision on, and then the Iowa Supreme Court went the opposite way. Interestingly enough, that case had some influence on the folks filing the lawsuit in Varnum v. Breen.
And Mark, your opinion? We have a little over a minute left.
Well, I totally agree with Tom. I can't really add much to that, but so I think I'll let it go.
Okay. All right. Well, Tom Witowski and Mark Hansen, retired Des Moines Register reporters and co-authors of Equal Before the Law, How Iowa Led Americans to Marriage Equality. And can you remind us, so this book is coming out this summer. When and where will it be available?
University of Iowa Press is publishing it, Emily. It is going to be coming out on June 1st. We hope that it will be in bookstores all over the state, but you can also order it directly from the University of Iowa Press website. And we would thank everybody for buying it, if they will. And we really do want to thank you for inviting us in.
Oh, yeah. Tom and Mark, thank you both so much.
Thank you, Emily.
You're listening to River to River. I'm Emily Woodbury in for Ben Kiefer. If you would like to join our conversation, you can give us a call at 1-866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk or send us an email at rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. We'll be back in just a few minutes and we'll hear from the plaintiffs whose cases are being considered by the U.S. Supreme Court today. And legal expert Todd Pettis will join me for analysis on these cases and potential outcomes of the court's decision. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Emily Woodbury, in for Ben Kiefer. The U.S. Supreme Court hears arguments today on whether there's a constitutional right to same-sex marriage. This half hour, I'm joined by legal expert Todd Pettis to discuss the possible impact of the cases in front of the Supreme Court. Todd is an associate dean for faculty and the H. Blair and Joan V. White Chair in Civil Litigation at the University of Iowa's College of Law. Hi, Todd. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for the invitation.
So what are the specific issues that the Supreme Court will decide on now?
Well, the court is hearing appeals from a total of 16 different couples in the states of Michigan, Ohio, Tennessee, and Kentucky. Those are the states that sit in the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, which is the court from which all these appeals come. And there's two big questions in front of the court this morning when they heard arguments. The first, and the one that's getting most of the attention, is whether the 14th Amendment of the Constitution, which is where we find the due process and equal protection clauses, whether that amendment requires a state to license same-sex marriages, and then separately, whether the 14th Amendment requires a state, even if it does not itself license same-sex marriages, to honor same-sex marriages that have been performed in other states. And the court heard about 2.5 hours of oral arguments on those subjects this morning.
And let's hear some of those oral arguments, the stories of the people who brought these cases. The arguments come from cases from, like you said, Ohio, Tennessee, Kentucky, and Michigan. Now, this piece of audio is provided by a piece from NPR's legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg. And as Totenberg explains it, many of the plaintiffs in these cases see themselves as, quote, accidental activists. Here's a story of Kentucky residents Paul Campion and Randy Johnson.
Paul, a school counselor, and Randy, a hospital administrator, have been together for 24 years, raising a family of 3 boys and 1 girl. Both come from large families. Paul, the youngest of 8, raised in a conservative Catholic family, was an altar boy. Randy, a Southern Baptist, went to church 3 times a week. As a teenager, he denied being gay for fear of being condemned to hell.
And then when I graduated from college, I decided that the only choice that I really was going to make was to not lie about who I was.
After falling in love, the couple began long conversations about having a family.
We thought originally that being a gay man meant not having a family, because that's what we saw. We decided that that did not have to be the case for us.
Like many of the couples in the gay marriage lawsuits, they decided to adopt. They searched long and hard to find an agency that would even consider them. And in February of 1995, these 2 preppy-looking white men rushed to the hospital to begin caring for their newborn African-American twin boys. Paul Campion.
Right from that moment, the kids were with us doing feedings every 3 hours, 4 hours, changing diapers. And so we immediately went into parent mode.
The adoption, however, was not final. And again, only 1 of the 2 parents could actually adopt. The couple decided that Paul would be the one. And their lawyer advised Randy not to be in court for fear that if the judge saw 2 men, it would raise questions. So Randy waited in the parking lot while Paul and his sister held the baby boys in the courtroom when the adoption was finalized. Randy Johnson.
It was a dream come true to actually become parents, and our lives have revolved around that role since that day, over 20 years ago.
Randy and Paul would eventually add to their family, adopting a daughter, now 12, and another son, now 16. The twins, now 20, are both in college. In 2008, when gay marriage was briefly legalized in California, the couple got married there. But their marriage is still not recognized in Kentucky. Paul Campion.
It affects us in so many ways. Death benefits, health insurance.
Because Kentucky does not recognize them as one family, they have to have 2 family health insurance policies. And when Paul was diagnosed with prostate cancer 3 years ago, they had to shop for a doctor who would recognize Randy as his full partner with decision-making power if necessary.
I think so many people being out nowadays just shows everybody how incredibly boring and normal we are.
Across the state line in Tennessee, veterinarians Sophie Jesty and Val Tanko are the quintessential high-achieving professional couple.
The decisions about where to live are often career-driven.
That's Sophie, a specialist in animal cardiology. Her spouse, Val, is a specialist in animal gynecology and fertility. They were married in New York in 2011 and began looking for jobs as academic veterinarians. They were elated when both were offered posts at the University of Tennessee, Knoxville, where they now teach, do clinical work, and conduct research. But Tennessee does not recognize their New York marriage. That presented further complications when Val got pregnant with their daughter Amelia through artificial insemination. Under Tennessee law, Sophie could not also be Amelia's legal parent. So they sued, and through a legal quirk, Sophie became the first female dad in Tennessee. Because Amelia was born in the short window of time where there was a court order requiring Tennessee to recognize their New York marriage, Sophie Jesty is listed on the birth certificate as Amelia's father.
Well, I'm definitely not a father, but, you know, the state on the birth certificates has only 2 slots. 1 is for mother and 1 is for father. So to be on the birth certificate, my name occupied the father slot.
That could change. If Tennessee wins its case, it could try to reissue Amelia's birth certificate. Though all these couples and more are part of the case that will be heard in the Supreme Court, the name that will go down in history is Jim Obergefell.
There was no expectation that this would turn into what it has.
Obergefell's case was the first filed, and the consolidated cases are known as Obergefell versus Hodges, Hodges being the Ohio official whose department handles death certificates. It is the death certificate of Obergefell's longtime partner that's at the center of their case. Jim Obergefell and John Arthur met in their mid-20s and soon became inseparable. Over the next two decades, they even worked together at various large corporate firms in service and training positions. Jim Obergefell.
It was John and Jim. Everybody knew it. It was no issue.
But in 2011, John was diagnosed with ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease. He quickly went from a cane to a walker to a wheelchair. The two men had talked about getting married, but the native Ohioans wanted to marry in their home state, and same-sex marriage was not legal there. In 2013, the Supreme Court struck down the federal law barring federal recognition of same-sex marriages performed in states where they're legal. John was in his bed in the living room when the news flashed across the TV screen.
I just immediately leaned over, hugged him, gave him a kiss, and said, "Let's get married." It just seemed like the most perfect thing possible to do at that moment.
Friends and family quickly raised the $13,000 for a medical charter to Maryland, and soon the couple was off with a nurse, medical technician, two pilots, and John's aunt, Paulette Roberts, who'd been ordained online so she could marry them. They landed on the tarmac at Thurgood Marshall Airport in Baltimore, and the ceremony commenced.
We got to make those promises to each other, those legal promises, and it was incredible. And within 15 minutes, we were back in the air, heading back to Cincinnati.
Jim says they just never thought about what would happen in Ohio.
And it wasn't until a few days after we got married that that issue was presented to us. And it was heartbreaking.
Through a friend, a civil rights lawyer came to Jim and John's home to explain that Ohio would not recognize the marriage.
He pulled out a blank death certificate and said, "Now, do you realize when John dies, the state of Ohio will say he's single, and this blank here for surviving spouse name will be blank. Your name won't show up there, Jim."
The couple immediately filed suit. Because of John's health, the judge heard arguments the following court day, and that same afternoon issued his ruling requiring the state to recognize Jim as John's spouse on a death certificate. 3 months and 11 days later, John Arthur died. The death certificate listed Jim Obergefell as his surviving spouse. If the state wins its case in the Supreme Court, it can reissue a death certificate without Jim's name.
We did not set out to be activists. We did not set out to become a named plaintiff at the Supreme Court. Nothing at all like that. We just simply wanted respect.
Obergefell knows his name will be on a landmark case, whichever way it goes.
But for me, it's still just about me and John. It's a very personal thing to me still.
That piece from NPR's legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Emily Woodbury, and I'm joined by Todd Pettis, a legal expert, joining us for the rest of the hour. Todd, a lot of personal stories there. You can tell that these plaintiffs were very carefully selected, weren't they?
They were. They're not, you know, they may be accidental plaintiffs in the sense that they don't set out in their lives to become plaintiffs, but when the attorneys are putting together cases of this sort, they're not taking just anybody who walks in the door. They're thinking very carefully about the kinds of backgrounds and facts and so forth that are going to eliminate unnecessary distractions and, frankly, make quite a compelling case to whichever judges might be assigned to hear them at the trial level.
Mm-hmm. And one of the cases that we didn't hear in that piece, April DeBoer and Jane Rouse, their case deals with adoption. Tell us a little bit about that case.
Yes, their case comes from Michigan. They're both nurses. One works in a neonatal unit, one works in an emergency room. I think they're at separate hospitals. But in the course of their job, they come across, of course, all kinds of tough cases, including those involving babies born to women who aren't fit to take care of them. They're licensed foster parents, so the state has decided that they can raise children in a healthy environment. They
in addition to being foster parents, decided to adopt. So they wanted to adopt these three children. Under Michigan law, only one of them can adopt. You can't jointly, two people can't jointly adopt unless they're married. And so their lawsuit started as a challenge to that ban, the denial of the ability to jointly adopt these children. That ran into some legal problems. And so the trial judge in that case said, you know, why don't you change your legal pleadings and just squarely take on Michigan's ban on same-sex marriage. And so that's exactly what they've done.
Because they're worried if something happened to one of them, they would lose possibly half their children.
Yeah. And medical decisions, you know, the child is hurt. Someone needs to make quick calls at the hospital about what exactly we're going to do by way of treatment. Parents are the ones that we look to. All kinds of things. Yet one of them dies. Who then is responsible for the child? There are a lot of things that when you're married and you have children, you just take those things for granted. Same-sex couples can't take those things for granted in a fairly large number of states.
Mm-hmm. Now, each of these cases are a little bit different. You know, they're focusing on adoption, right to a name on a death certificate, whether marriage is recognized state by state. Will the Supreme Court decide on each of these cases separately, or will they issue a more comprehensive ruling? Because, of course, federal recognition of same-sex marriage would cover all of these cases.
They're not going to divide it up in terms of, you know, the adoption cases or the death certificate cases. They're not going to divide them up that way. It's theoretically possible that they could divide them up by the states that are in front of them. It's possible, I think highly, highly unlikely, but it's theoretically possible that they could say, well, the ban on same-sex marriage in this state was enacted for the following purposes and so forth, and that's not constitutionally permissible. But in another state, the story is different. That's possible. As I say, I think that's unlikely. And so they framed the issue that they're going to address in very broad terms. Does the Constitution, specifically the 14th Amendment, require a state to recognize same-sex marriage? And all of these other issues about death certificates and adoption and medical decision-making and health insurance policies and all of those things, the answers to those questions will either fall into place as a natural consequence of what the court says or will have to be dealt with in subsequent years of lawmaking and litigation.
Mm-hmm. Now, in the previous half of the show, we compared what's happening in Iowa with the Varnum decision to what happened in Iowa to what's happening on a national scale. Do you think, looking at the Varnum case, does Iowa interpret the Equal Protection Clause in the Iowa Constitution differently to how the U.S. Supreme Court interprets the Equal Protection Clause at a federal level?
Well, they frame the questions in the same way. When you do equal protection analysis, you start by looking at the trait that the government has seized upon to distinguish between people. So is the government distinguishing between people based on their age or their sex or their race or anything like that? And then we say, okay, now how skeptically or deferentially should a court examine that legislative classification or distinction? So the Iowa Supreme Court in interpreting the Iowa Constitution and now the U.S. Supreme Court in interpreting the federal Constitution, they start from those similar place, from those same kinds of places. The Iowa Supreme Court went further and interpreted the Iowa Constitution in ways that the U.S. Supreme Court has not yet interpreted the federal Constitution. Specifically, the Iowa Supreme Court said that when a state makes distinctions between people based on their sexual orientation, you have to satisfy what attorneys in courts call heightened scrutiny, which means the government has to have quite a powerful argument, quite a powerful justification for distinguishing between people on that basis. The U.S. Supreme Court has not yet said, when it comes to the federal Constitution, whether courts should be similarly skeptical or should be highly deferential to the distinction that the legislature has drawn. And it's possible in this case that we'll get an answer to that question.
Well, let's talk predictions. How divided is the court, and how do you predict the justices will rule?
Well, the court's very divided. Justice Scalia, Justice Alito, Justice Thomas in prior decisions have made it quite clear that they are not going to sign on to a ruling that finds a federal constitutional right to same-sex marriage. So their minds would have to be changed in a fairly profound way. Chief Justice Roberts has written a little bit skeptically about it, but there was a bit more of an open door with him. It's you know, sometimes we focus on Justice Kennedy as a swing vote, maybe out of laziness or something, but he's absolutely at the heart of this case. When you read the briefs, they're clearly targeted at him. There's lots of quotations from past Justice Kennedy opinions. He's widely regarded as the justice who's going to swing the outcome in one direction or the other. So the outcome will certainly be divided. I think we're going to have multiple opinions. I don't think it'll just be one majority opinion and one dissenting opinion. I think a lot of the individual justices are going to want to write separately, partly for history's sake. If they are a justice, for example, ruling against same-sex marriage, I think some of the justices are going to want to write to history to make clear that it's not because of any narrow-mindedness on their part, but rather driven rather by something like the proper view of the courts and letting voters and their elected leaders decide questions of this sort. In terms of what the outcome will be, I don't have any more knowledge than anybody else does. I will say that Justice Scalia, in a couple of different cases, one from 2003, Lawrence versus Texas, and one in 2013, which is the DOMA case, in both of those cases, Justice Scalia wrote very forceful dissents, and in both of those cases, he predicted that it was only a matter of time before a majority of the U.S. Supreme Court would rule that there is a federal constitutional right to same-sex marriage. He made it very clear he wasn't happy about that, but he said in both cases, you know, the majority is telling us now that they're not reaching that issue. He says, don't be fooled. It's just a matter of time before they lay this on us, and we'll see whether that prediction comes true.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things I think that, you know, not to speak for the public, but the public, is, you know, when looking at these cases, it's hard for them to understand where the justices are coming from. And today, Justice Scalia and Justice Kennedy expressed concern over changing an idea that's been in effect, quote, for millennia. And, obviously courts are cautious about change. But why is that so important that just because something's been in effect for millennia, why should that matter?
Yeah, and Justice Kennedy led the, as you've indicated, Justice Kennedy led the question on that score by saying, you know, marriage for millennia now marriage has been defined as between one man and one woman. And aren't you asking us to change the institution of marriage in quite a profound way? And Chief Justice Roberts asked similar questions. Those questions, which to me are kind of one of the headlines from the oral arguments this morning, those questions go to a very basic legal question about the proper role of the courts in recognizing and defending rights, individual rights under the federal Constitution. As a general matter, the rights that are most strongly protected by the Constitution are those that are spelled out explicitly, such as, for example, your right to free speech or the right to free exercise of religion, your right not to be cruelly and unusually punished. Those rights are spelled out in black and white. They need interpretation, but the language of the rights is there. Now, should the Supreme Court or other courts ever forcefully protect individual rights that are not spelled out in the Constitution, such as, for example, a right to privacy or a right to abortion? Well, there things become very controversial. One point on which there is common ground among the justices in many past cases, though not all, is that if a right has a deep tradition, an unenumerated right, a right that's not spelled out in the Constitution, but if it has a deep tradition and goes back many, many generations, then it is more appropriate for the court to get involved in forcefully defending that right. If instead a right appears to be newly conceived, has not been around for very long, then in many past cases, the Supreme Court has taken that as a sign that it should not get forcefully involved and should defer very substantially to whatever the elected leaders are saying the law should be. And so when Justice Kennedy asks the plaintiff's attorney this morning, what are we supposed to do? What do you do with the fact that marriage has been thought of as being between one man and one woman for, you know, hundreds and hundreds of years, and it's really only been since 2003 when Massachusetts became the first court of any kind in this country to recognize a right to same-sex marriage, so that's about a dozen years ago. This is a very new right, and so how can you ask us to overrule the bans on same-sex marriage that exist in a majority of states?
Mm-hmm. Well, we only have a minute or so left, but, This is a new right. It's also a very divisive issue that's very influenced by public opinion. What's important to recognize when the court's looking at something that's so has such strong views in the public?
Well, Judge Sutton, who is the judge who wrote the appellate ruling below, he's the judge for the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals who wrote the ruling that is currently being reviewed by the U.S. Supreme Court. He made the point in his ruling that when an issue is very divisive and it concerns a right that's not clearly spelled out in the Constitution, we need to defer to the democratic process. And that then becomes one of the prime issues in front of the U.S. Supreme Court now. Should we defer on this or should we step in and end the democratic debate about whether same-sex marriage ought to be protected?
Well, Todd, thank you so much for coming in today.
My pleasure.
Todd is with the University of Iowa's College of Law. Todd Pettis. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Emily Woodbury, in for Ben Kiefer. River to River is produced by Claire Roth and Lindsay Moon, with production assistance from Julia Davis. Production assistance today from Dennis Reese and John Pemple. Thanks so much for joining us. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.